everyone, and welcome back to the 16mm Film Crew. I'm Cindy.
And I'm Dale.
You can watch us on YouTube. You can like and comment on our YouTube videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can listen to us everywhere podcasts are found at 16mm Film Crew Podcasts. Leave us a rate and review. And visit us on our website at www.16mmfilmcrew.com. This week, we are talking about Maestro, directed by Bradley Cooper, or Maestro. Maestro is a 2023 American biographical romantic drama film that centers on the relationship between American composer Leonard Bernstein and his wife Felicia Montalegre. It stars Bradley Cooper as Leonard Bernstein, Carey Mulligan as Felicia, Matt Balmer as David Oppenheim, Sarah Silverman as Sherry Bernstein, and Maya Hawke as Jamie Bernstein. So, Dale, what are your thoughts on this movie?
This was not a picture I was expecting to be as blown away by it. It's clear that Bradley Cooper, like he did as far as, you know, producing, writing, directing, he put his heart into this. This is, you know, I can see why the talk of him in this movie is he's in contention for, you know, an Oscar win based on the performance of this movie.
Yeah, I thought this movie was fine. I thought it was an interesting way to tell someone's life. I think that I liked that they didn't just focus on Leonard Bernstein's accomplishments, but they really focused on his relationship with his wife, Felicia. And the story really centers around her. So I thought that was a good way to tell the story, because it would have just been like another run-of-the-mill biopic if it was kind of just done in the standard way, which it usually is. So I like that they did something different with it.
Yeah, this movie is really the most story of, I don't like stories that, you know, where men or women, it doesn't really matter, you know, their temptations post-marriage. I mean, I don't really enjoy pictures about it. Like, it's weird. Because it's like, his excuse to this whole movie of, you know, he is in a relationship with David and I guess David's wife at one time, and then he calls things off with David when he starts getting his attraction for Felicia and gets married. His excuse for his behavior is that he has so much love. And I feel you. I really feel like people whose responses to cheating and all those kind of behaviors say, oh, I just have so much love that if I don't share it, I become depressed. You're not functioning as a responsible adult in the ways that you should. You know.
Yeah. I think that what I liked about this movie was, one, the performances. I thought the performances were great. I think Bradley Cooper did an amazing job, like really disappeared into the role. Like, he was so good in it. One of his best performances, I will say. And also Carey Mulligan, this is one of her best performances I've ever seen. Like, she just did such an amazing job, especially towards the end as she gets older. Like, girl was killing it. Like, she really was pulling it out. So I'm all of the hype around like what they delivered in this film in terms of like their performances as artists, as actors, I thought that was completely deserved because they really did an amazing job. And I thought the interesting part about the relationship was that Leonard Bernstein, what I think they're trying to tell us is that he's probably bisexual. I think that's what I was gathering from it. And how you navigate being that sexuality in the 1940s and 50s, where it's like, I don't know if it was illegal to be gay, but it was very, very looked down upon. So like, it's very interesting, but also like, there was an acceptance amongst certain communities, especially like the art community, the theater community, musicians, like where it was fine to be that way. But I just feel like committing to a marriage was almost like a cover. Not that he didn't love his wife. I totally believe he did. But I also feel like it was kind of just safer to be married to a woman. So like there wasn't questions and stuff like that. The guy who he's having an affair with, Matt Bomer, also gets married at a certain point. And it's almost like he doesn't really want to do it, but it's just, you have to kind of, and that's, yeah, that society is like, you have to conform. So it's really, so I thought it was interesting that they kind of, they didn't focus on that completely, but they did kind of put that in there. So you knew like, this is what they were up against in their day. But I really do like that that Felicia was also an actor. And so you have these two artists living together, working together in a lot of cases. Like he would write things and she would help him out. Like they were very like, they were very much a team. And what was interesting is that like she had to sacrifice a lot of the things that she wanted to do in order to be with him, because he was the great Leonard Bernstein. He was iconic, a genius for people. And I feel like that must have been really difficult. And they kind of talk about that a little bit in the film, where it's like, at first she seems like she doesn't mind the sacrifice. And towards the end, it seems like it actually has taken a toll on her. Like she really had to give a lot of things up in order to be his wife, have all the kids, you know, kind of dim her light so his light can continue to shine. So I thought that that was really interesting. That's why I liked how in the story, so I guess in the writing of it, Bradley Cooper and I think Josh Singer, who wrote the script, did a good job on like finding a viewpoint of like how to tell the story about this man. Because again, it could have been like a really basic biopic. And I think that what I like is that they did incorporate his wife, who was his partner in his life, basically, like into it so much and really center around her character. Because a lot of times you hear about great men, but you don't hear about the women who weren't with them on the come up and who stayed with them as they continued to shine for the rest of the world and kind of kept things together. They're always kind of left out of history. And I think that it's great that they incorporated her into this. And last thing, Carey Mulligan, I was watching an interview with the round table Hollywood actresses thing. And she was saying that like, it seemed like Felicia didn't really mind the fact that he was cheating on her a bunch, like, which he was before and after they got married. Yeah. But she said what was the most or the biggest betrayal for her was the fact that he went to another person. There's another guy who kind of shows up in like the 70s and stuff, and he ends up leaning on him more.
Yeah.
And having him being more of his partner in life than she was for a couple of years. And I think for her, that was the most hurtful thing. It's like, I'm the person who's supposed to be there for you, not anyone else. So like, I can disregard everything else that you're doing, but like, I still need to be like your right-hand person. And if she felt that that role was being taken from her, and that's what made her really angry, sad. It seemed like it was leading towards like, they were going to split up at a certain point. So I thought that was an interesting insight of just like, but also like probably the mindset of like most women who were in like unhappy marriages or in challenging marriages around that time period, but they stayed with their person, they stayed with their spouse. It was almost just like finding a way to compartmentalize and like accept what was happening and just get on with it, which I couldn't do that. So
yeah, the phrase that comes to mind is Dolly Parton. Her Dolly Parton song, apparently, when I think it's like the 90s, when, you know, Bill Clinton was like being accused in the White House for cheating and stuff at sexual affairs. In an interview, she was like, oh, I'm going to stand by my man. You know, is that kind of thing. And I think you really hit the nail on the head about their relationship. She was okay with the physical aspect of him just doing whatever, but it does come to a head when that, do they even mention that man's name? Like, he just shows up at a party?
I think they do.
No, they do? But yeah, anyway, he shows up and then they're out on events and, you know, they're going to theater events, opera events, and he's there with them. And then that scene where she looks at them and they're just holding each other's hands, that's like, that's her breaking point, like, for her, and it rolls over to everything else. Where, and even she says herself when she's talking to Sarah Silverman's character about she thought that she could handle all that, you know, fine with the cheating, but it's the emotional side of it she was not, you know, prepared for, you know. And it comes to a head, you know, when they're at Thanksgiving and he's thinking it's a joke about her, him kicking her out, and she's like, no, I'm dead serious, like, I can't do this anymore, you know, kind of thing. And it is a really, really sad story. But yeah, Carey Mulligan, I don't think, and it's weird, she's had like a long career since like, from like 2005, acting and stuff, you know, Public Enemies, you know, Drive, all that. But this run she's on, like, the last couple years is, like, astounding to me. Like, she's, like, approaching, like, this might sound sacrilegious to some people, but she's, like, approaching, like, a Meryl Streep level in her career, like, so soon. It's, like, really undeniable. Carey Mulligan.
Yeah, she's always been a really great actress. I think for me, it's like she gives more in certain films than others. She's kind of find like a comparable person for her to like really emphasize this example. But like to me, she's like a more established Anya Taylor-Joy, where it's like, you know, Anya's a great actress, but sometimes, like, she'll give performances where you're just like, okay, it wasn't, like, I've seen you do better.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that for me with Carey. I feel like there have been certain movies that she's really given so much. One of my favorite movies that she's ever done is Never Let Me Go, which she did with Andrew Garfield and Keira Knightley. She did a great job. And that was my first thing I saw her in. I saw her in Pride and Prejudice first, but, like, that was a great performance because it's very quiet and very subtle. Like, all the characters are very restrained. So, like, to give everything that she gave, and I was literally crying at the end of that movie. Like, everyone in that cast did an amazing job, but, like, she's always been a great actress. And I think now, maybe just her years in the industry, working with really great people, like, she is at, like, her peak with this. Like, this was an incredible performance that she delivered. Because, again, it's Leni Bernstein's movie, but it's really her movie. Like, it's really about
her, yeah.
Her in a lot of ways. So she was carrying all of that, and I feel like she did. And her and Bradley just had like a really good connection. Like, I totally believe their relationship and everything. So yeah, she was great in that. Another thing that I loved, well, the rest of the things that I love is the technical aspects of this film. This film is shot beautifully. It is done really well. I think the cinematographer is Matthew Lipatic. Great job. I don't like some of the editing choices. Wasn't a fan of all of those. I thought that we could have done better in that area. When I say technical aspects, what I really mean is like, in terms of like, I'm talking about like cinematography.
Yeah.
Not every single thing was great. Like, I wasn't in love with the black and white turning into color. I wasn't a huge fan of that. But there are definitely, I think the way that they approached this film was almost like a play, where it's like really long takes. You're not cutting a whole bunch. So you're really seeing people like the fullness of like what they have to say. You're seeing like full conversations. They'll do certain shot choices, like, there's one argument that they have at their house, Lenny and Felicia, where it's a master. So it's like it's a wide shot, and they're like hidden at, they're like sitting at the pool, but you don't really see them. They're like behind the trees and stuff. And they're having that argument where you're like, oh, is she going to say something that's really going to tip this over? And then she kind of pulls back, and then he goes forward and he kind of pulls back. So it's an interesting scene that you're used to just seeing people close up, and they'll cut from like one person's face to the next person's face and back and forth like that. But they chose to do it a different way, which I thought was like, okay, that's interesting. And the scene where he is performing at the opera, where he's conducting at the some opera in London at some church, that was done really well, because that was all looks like one take. And everything, and there's so many components to it, like, he really had to like learn how to conduct just to do that scene, like,
yeah.
So that was done really well, so I liked that. Other things could have been worked on. Yeah
This movie was shot on film, on Kodak film. They used Panaflex Millennium cameras. I think The Dark Knight Rises or Dark Knight was shot on one of those. Of course, Saltburn, No Time to Die. It is a well-used camera and a film. My thing on it, like, I understand they wanted to kind of format everything as far as the aspect ratio as the time evolves. As, you know, it's like the 1940s, 50s. Everything is black and white and everything is kind of more 4x3-ish. My thing was, is because it's still, it still did not, even though it's shot on film, the level of camera is so intense. It did not feel the same way. Like, I know they're going to mimic the filming and the look and feel of, you know, movies from that day and age. But I guess because it's still kind of digital-esque in a way, because I think, the natural frame grain that occurs in film was not on this picture, because I think it's revealed that Netflix removes film grain on streaming for bandwidth issues. So because it was so highly detailed with that, the film grain being removed, I couldn't get immersed, because I'm thinking, okay, this is not supposed to be 1940s, 1950s. I want to mimic and, you know, the camera movements and the frame rates in a way to mimic those things, and I wanted like the shooting style to be that way, because if you're gonna go that far to have the aspect ratios and your color palette as far as, you know, being black and white, and as it transitions to color, and you want to also be a part of a story, like I look at how The Lighthouse used that aspect ratio on black and white as a storytelling device to showcase claustrophobia, surrealist paranoia. Like, the aspect ratio and the color and the use of the editing and color really helped in tell the story. In this movie, it kind of doesn't as much. Like, they could have, the whole movie could have been looking like it was like in the early 90s and 1980s in color with a wider aspect ratio, and the movie would have been fine. You know, the only time I really thought, like, oh, this looks like a 1940s to 1960s picture is the scene where they're being interviewed in their loft house, their penthouse, and then the camera angle switches to a broadcast camera of it, and you see, like, their hands, the shutter speed on their hands move, like, all, I was like, okay, now this is what I want. If you're gonna tell me this is 1940s, I want the camera and everything and the visuals I'm being given to mimic that. And then they just did that for like 10 seconds and they went right back to, oh, it's full crispy and digital, and I hated it. I mean, I think Matthew LeBeck, wonderful cinematographer. This is like his second project with Bradley Cooper from A Star Is Born. You know, he worked on Black Swan. I think his work is amazing, but the technical side of this movie wasn't really it for me. You know, like, they did a lot of I love the transitions in the beginning of the movie, because they use a lot of Texas switches to change locations, and the frequency in which they use them, you don't really see that often in modern Hollywood. It's like an old Hollywood technique, not really used that much, and I love the fact that they used it, because it really showed they were thinking on another level to show the passage of time and the changing of locations and stuff like that. But, like, just the cameras, just the look of the camera, just, I couldn't get fully immersed in the story on that. I don't know, that's just me.
Yeah, I get that. I feel like sometimes directors use film cameras because it's, I guess, a more prestigious thing to be using, not because it's actually going to further the story that you're telling. Because to me, I thought this was all shot on digital. If you didn't say it was shot on film, I would have never known that. Because that's what it looked like. It looked like it was shot on digital film, which is why I didn't like, I guess I didn't, that's why I didn't appreciate the black and white to color thing. Because I feel like there's another film that did that. I think it was like Belfast that did that too, where it was shot digitally, but it was in black and white. And there was something about that I was just like, I don't know. I'm not really feeling it. But then you have a film like Mank, which was shot beautifully. So it's like, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. unfortunately, I'm not as technically proficient in my language of how to describe it. I just know that, like, sometimes it looks good and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, like, Mank itself, and the thing with Mank was shot digital on a red camera.
Wow.
You know, but just like the visual style of those era elements and strung up in the film, you know, it worked. Like, I think some of the backgrounds in this movie were, like, a little bit too crisp for me or whatever. But, yeah, I think, like you said, I think people, like, I was like that for a while. Like, in college, I had just seen, Robert Rodriguez picture. I forget what the name of the movie, but I was hella set on every project I had to do in college was black and white, but with one feature in color for everything, just because it looked cool, not because it benefited the story or anything. Mm-hmm. I was like, that shit's fire. Robert Rodriguez and Frank Miller, that is crazy. Sin City, that's the movie. Like, I saw Sin City, and I wanted to mimic black and white in some element. Either it could be blue or it could be yellow. One thing was always going to be in color. And I did that in, like, every project, my graphic design stuff, everything. And I just did it because I thought that shit was fire. Not understanding how that was aided in telling the story. Like you said, I think some directors or some cinematographers sometimes do stuff just because it looks cool, without really having any intention on how this impacts and helps the story at all.
Yeah. So, there's that. But yeah. So I thought that was... I liked looking at it sometimes, but I totally understand what you're saying. It's like... Yeah. I think that another thing that I didn't really like was... some of the writing. I feel like I like their focus. Like, I like where they wanted to position this film and it seemed like they were confident in the story that they knew they wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
That was great. I just feel like some of the dialogue was a little bit corny. Is that the word? Yeah. It was a little corny sometimes in some places. And also because there are so many scenes, like I said, that play like you're like watching an actual play on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You have to fill all of those spaces with dialogue. And I feel like sometimes it just went on a little too long. And I kind of do wish that they cut in certain places, because it's either reinforcing an idea that we've already know, like that's already been explained, or it's like just way too on the nose with what it's trying to say.
Yeah.
So I don't know. There's some spots where I'm just like, not really sure about the writing. It didn't connect to me as deeply. Like, I felt way more connected to Felicia than I did to Lenny. And this is I think the way this movie is promoted, it's about Leonard Bernstein. Now, when you watch it, it's more about Felicia. But that's what I thought I was watching, was a story really about him. And I feel like I didn't connect to this depiction of his personality. Like, he obviously has stuff from his childhood that gets mentioned, but doesn't really get explored. So I don't know. It was kind of, I think Bradley Cooper did a good job with the material, but in terms of like, did I connect deeply to this character? Not really. Do I feel like I know their version of Leonard Bernstein? Not really. So I don't know. I kind of left not feeling much after I watched this. Like, I thought the performances were great, but in terms of like how I was feeling about it, I was like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like Tar did this way better.
Yeah, way better. Way better.
Not even a real conductor.
You know, and the thing about this, and this movie is weird because it's biographical romance drama, but then some advertisers call it a musical, like, and that's the thing. Like, I'm thinking, all right, cool, I'm gonna get knowledge on Leonard Bernstein, one of the greatest composers in American in film history. I'm gonna get, you know, part of his inspiration on creating and composing some of this stuff. Didn't get none of that, and that's something I would have loved to actually gain insight for, you know. And the one thing I do love in this movie is because they are some musical cues to a lot of his projects. I've heard I've heard pieces, particularly from West Side Story, pop up like 2 or 3 times in it. So it's good when you get to hear those pieces that you you're familiar with in this movie. I do think sometimes they were really not in sections where they would fit melodically in a way, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. I think the only time I think they did is at one point when they go to their house out of the city, and a musical cue from West Side Story is playing, and they're just like walking through the house. And I was like, okay, it's kind of an upbeat song where the Jets and, you know, the Sharks about to fight, and they're like pirouetting all over the place, and y'all just walking through the house. I don't, what are you trying to tell me here? Like, you know, that those are the kind of things. But it's clear in this movie is Bradley Cooper in his career did what it took Matthew McConaughey a much longer time to do, because for both, they were both categorized as the funny hot guy who's in kind of bad movies. But it's not until like the last couple of years where, of course, Matthew McConaughey did Lincoln Lawyer, that he went back to doing the idiot husband boyfriend kind of movies, and then now he's kind of like, since Interstellar, he's gotten serious parts. But Bradley Cooper stopped that like real fast. Like, no, I think 18 was like his last jokey movie. He's like, no, now I want to do serious stuff. Like, and he talks about the training to learn how to conduct. And if you know music, or like, I played an orchestra as a cellist growing up. People kind of think when conductors are conducting, they're just moving their hands, but every motion is communicating a different movement, how you go with the time measures, everything. And for him to actually sit there and actually learn how to do that, kudos to him. He's kind of like a not crazy version of Jared Leto. Like, Jared Leto talks about how his method does all these crazy things, like Suicide Squad, he was setting like pigs, like severed pigs to the cast. Like, I see Bradley Cooper in that way. He's very methodical. He's very much a method actor. And you can tell he's an actor's actor. Like, we talk about auteur directors. I think he's one of those actors, like, who, if you love acting, like, and we shouldn't be surprised. I remember watching Inside the Actor's Studio where he trained, and he's James Lipton, I think, is interviewing, I think, Al Pacino. And Bradley Cooper, like, in the middle of the interview, like, asks a question. You know, stuff like that. I feel like he's one of those actors who's always had it very intentional with what he does. Like, he has the passion and insightfulness for it that it took Leo a long time to develop, is how I view Bradley's performances and the way he's moving as an actor right now.
Yeah, I think when you look at who people align themselves with, that shows you a lot about like who they are, who they aspire to be. Like, the fact that he connected with Robert De Niro, Martin Scorsese, and Steven Spielberg really quickly, where it's like he wanted to be around these guys. I think Steven Spielberg produced this movie. Like, he seems very much like one of those people who not only care about acting, but also take it like deeply seriously.
Yeah.
On an almost pretentious kind of level. Yeah. So that's kind of where Bradley's at. And I think that I like that ambition. I think that that's great. But I also think, like, because he wants to do that, he's like, also like, I'm going to take on all these jobs. So I'm going to write it, and I'm also going to direct it, and I'm going to star in it. And it's like, I don't know anyone who has been able to do even 2 out of 3 of those things well in a film. I don't think I've seen that yet. I think even with actors who direct, like, they're not, some of them aren't starring in their own movies. So like Greta Gerwig directs, but she won't be in the movie that she's directing. Yeah. And I feel like that's probably a better way to do it. Like, if you want to write it and direct it, don't star in it. Or if you want to star in it and write it, don't direct it. Like, because I just feel like one thing is always going to fall by the wayside. Like, I don't know if you can do all jobs to the same level. Not that I've seen. I think he did a great job in A Star Is Born, but A Star Is Born is based on other movies, so it's not like he had to do much with that. But I just feel like with this, wearing all of those hats, I'm not sure if the performance was great. There could have been better choices made with the writing and maybe the directing as well. So, like, I don't know. I think that sometimes it's okay to let other people do it. Like, that's kind of just my philosophy. Like, it's okay that I don't do all of these things. Maybe I don't need to do all of these things. And I feel like maybe if Bradley does, like, maybe just 2 out of 3 of those things, he'll probably be fine. Because I feel like one of the discussions that have come out of this movie is the fact that, like, it seems like he very much wants an Oscar and that this is a very Oscar-baity movie. And I don't know. I feel like, from what I understand, there has been no directors and actor who like, directed the movie that they're acting in and also wrote it has ever won an Oscar before. So... Mm-hmm. I don't know if this was maybe that's not his intention. Maybe that's just the conversation that's going around him. Maybe he doesn't care. I don't know. But I also just kind of feel like I think he wants his work to be discussed in a similar vein as a Scorsese or as a Spielberg. And I'm not saying it can't, but I'm just thinking maybe let's like not do all the jobs. That's kind of, maybe that'll work out better for you. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I like his... I think he's an exceptional actor. And I don't know if there's, like, anyone I would compare him to exactly, because he is kind of multi-talented in a way that other actors kind of just focus on the acting part. But I do think that it was probably his goal always to not stay in those kind of rom-com-y, like...
Yeah.
Funny movies, even though the guy who directed The Hangover directed Joker, so
yeah.
Todd Fields? Yeah. Todd Haynes? I can't remember.
Yeah, same Todd. Director.
So yeah, I think it's smart that he's doing this, that he's producing more. I think that that's great for him. And I do think this movie is like good. I think it's good. I just don't, it's not like the best thing I've seen. And I guess it didn't leave me feeling much either. I was just like, yeah, this is a good movie. This will definitely be nominated for stuff. People will definitely be talking about this because it's that kind of film.
Yeah, you mentioned like the timeline for him being a part, like you mentioned, of course, Scorsese and Spielberg on it. You know, this was originally a Paramount picture. And Scorsese was going to direct it. And then he decides to do The Irishman instead. And then Bradley comes in to star and direct. And then Scorsese's like, fine, I'll produce it. And Spielberg comes in saying he's gonna help produce. And then Spielberg's like, I might want to direct. He just wants Bradley to star in it. But then he offered the position of directing to Bradley after seeing A Star Is Born. You know, so, and that's like to get the credentials from Scorsese and Spielberg as an actor, like, look, this is your first attempt at directing, but then after seeing A Star Is Born, your first directorial debut of anything, and they say, you know what, you got it. That is like the biggest, like as much as I can complain about the technical side of this movie and somewhat from the cinematographer, I do say, you know, Bradley did an amazing job in this project. There are some scenes where he's in it where it is kind of hard because you're acting to direct yourself acting and tell the camera, like there are some frames that hold on too long on people singly in the shot. Like there's one scene early in the movie after him and Felicia are flirting on the stage, you know, and he's like, oh, I didn't know your dad ran this place. And she walks to stage right. Well, yeah, for stage right, if you're watching, he walks stage left. The frame holds on her and it's kind of like, it's really awkward. In a way, when you know there are two people talking, but you don't really see the other person, you know they're there and they're off frame, those kind of things. Where I think in those scenes, had you know the frame actually been wide and you see Bradley at one end and her at one end, it would have made sense. But it's those kind of those small directorial slash editing issues that I have a tick with are my only glaring issues with this project. Like, other than that, I think he did, like, an amazing job on both ends of the camera, you know?
Solid. I thought it was solid.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like, because Bradley Cooper, I think the first thing he directed was American Sniper, and then he did A Star Is Born, and then he did this.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you're on your third picture, you definitely have your footing in terms of, like, your style of directing. Mm-hmm. So I didn't watch those other two films, so I cannot speak to what he did in those. I'm sorry.
Well, he produced. He was one of the producers for American Sniper. Spielberg. Clint Eastwood directed it. Yeah.
So yeah. That's right. I almost forgot about that, man. Clint Eastwood did direct that. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
A Star Is Born was the film that he did before. And I didn't watch it, so I can't speak to what he did in it, but I heard it was really good, so. But yeah, so I feel like you still have your footing. Like, I mean, I guess you're still kind of finding it, I guess, if it's your second film. Unless you have, like, a really, because there are first-time directors who have a very strong, like, this is what I do, this is my style. It's very easy to understand. I don't know. I think that there were choices made in this where I was kind of just like, did we really need that? Or, like, we couldn't cut that. And, like, if you're a director, you're in the editing bay with your editor the entire time, or in most cases, the entire time while your editor is editing the picture. Like, you're putting it together as a team. So, yeah. I don't know. This movie was good, but I also feel like, I don't know. It's a feeling thing. Was I moved by this delivery? And I cannot say that I was. And the whole time that I was watching it, I really was just thinking about Tar. Like, not even because they're a similar thing, just because they're, like, both conductors, but I also just feel like what they were doing in that film was so interesting and unexpected. And I also just was like, who is this person? Not even a real conductor, not a real person. Like, the fact that we were all, like, Googling, like, is this a real story that drops?
Yeah.
To the testament, one, of the writing, very strong, and the direction, and also all of the performances. Like, so, I guess my thing is, like, I'm kind of afraid that Bradley Cooper wants to be his hero so bad that he's trying to make movies like they do instead of, like, finding his own voice. I think that's kind of where I am with Bradley. But I could be wrong. And everyone has their own varying opinions on, like, how they feel about him as a director, as an actor. I think his acting is kind of undisputed. I think he's a terrific actor. Yeah. Like, that is just the truth. But, like, in terms of his films, I guess that's... Maybe that for a debate, maybe it's not. Maybe I'm just creating this debate by myself. I don't know. So, but
yeah, we'll see. I enjoyed the picture as far as, you know, the visual and the, like, let's talk about textbook. Like, I enjoyed those parts. I enjoyed the fact that I went into kind of see a movie about Leonard Bernstein, and I was switched into watching a movie. But it's essentially about his wife, you know, and her disillusionment with their marriage. But all in all, I did, like, it solidified, like, I do think, you know, I think these last couple of years, my rankings of actors has changed, because now, like, both Bradley and, you know, Kay Mulligan, they're, like, slowly, like, rising to the top of my list of actors, you know. I'm not separating the two of them, you know, actors, know that I think they're both phenomenal actors. But yeah.
Yeah, they're really good. I think it's going to take a little bit more for me to be like, you are like De Niro Streep level. I'm not there yet with them, but soon, I'm sure that they'll get there. They're on their way. And also Maya Hawke is in this movie, so I was like, I'm down. Yeah. The girly is in the movie. I enjoyed that.
When I heard, of course, Sarah Silverman as his sister, I was like, okay, Sarah Silverman's featured there a lot. Maya Hawke, anybody could have played that role. It wasn't really a thing to me. Matt Bomer, like, since that man's White Collar days, I was like, look, this man should be leading, should be like a star in Hollywood. And I feel like he's never gotten a chance to really show that he's like a phenomenal actor. Like, let's be honest, Matthew Bomer has like perfect like leading man aesthetic. If you look at that man, you know, he should be given a lot more opportunities to like lead as an actor. But yeah, one thing I find really good is we talked about accents the other day, with I think Baltimore accents or whatever.
Boston
accents. In this movie, I thought everybody's like mid-Atlantic accent was perfect. And the thing with mid-Atlantic accents, it is so hard to do because nobody talks like that anymore.
Right.
Only other few actresses I know that I can speak with a mid-Atlantic accent on command is like Tilda Swinton, because she was always doing period pieces. But other than that, it's really hard to do like those weird high-pitched mid-Atlantic accents, because we don't have them anymore. It's not like you can go to dialect coach and, you know, get one. So I applaud everybody in this picture for, you know, getting that down pat perfectly.
Yeah. I thought it was, I don't know if anyone ever spoke like that. I feel like someone did it in a movie once and then everyone just copied it. But yeah, I thought it was really good. I thought it was going to be annoying at first, but I think that because everyone committed to it, I was like, okay, I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. If one or two people do it, then it gets annoying. But if the whole cast is in on it and going with it, then it works. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So up first is a bit of news. I know we spent like a long time covering the strike last year and the concerns from SAG-AFTRA. But earlier this month, or January 12th of your listening, SAG-AFTRA agreed to a deal to license their actors' digital voice replicas for use in video games. They, of course, intellectual personal property has been a big issue with regenerative AI. Like past Sunday night, if you're watching football games, Matthew McConaughey is in like an AI generated commercial as well. But the union struck a deal with a platform at CSS, which allows them to mimic the voice of the actors, and they signed an agreement with the organization. In each individual contract is subject to negotiation. So if you want to use, you know, like Bradley Cooper's voice in a project that you don't want to pay Bradley Cooper to be in, you got them to still negotiate for the rights to use his voice, and the actors can opt out at any time for using their voice, like game franchises and stuff like that. A lot of people found this weird because, like we said before, in trying to explain how SAG-AFTRA works, SAG-AFTRA is responsible not just for your TV and film actors, but your voiceover artists, your recording people who work for radio stations. It's a large swath of people who do acting on different tiers and levels. So the concern is for this is, if I can hire, you know, this actor, I have no need to hire a voice actor to give a good performance. So that's where the issue comes in with SAG-AFTRA. Now you have all these big name screen actors who can get video game and voiceover money for like audiobooks and stuff. And now the voiceover actors, the voice actors, can't get that pie anymore. Because why would I go for this unknown person when I can say my character's voice by, you know, such and such a character? So I just want to know. We're still waiting for more details on how that goes, but it's still kind of a touchy subject considering that they were striking for that issue, and now they've turned around and kind of excommunicated a group within their ranks with this agreement.
Okay, next story we have is that Paul Thomas Anderson and Warner Brothers are set to have a new film starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Sean Penn, and Regina Hall, which will shoot this year in California. It will be his next picture after Licorice Pizza. This is interesting because I don't know, has Leo worked with Paul Thomas Anderson before?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Not to my knowledge.
So
that would be interesting to see what that dynamic will look like. Apparently it's supposed to be more accessible and like commercial than his other films previously, but I'm excited for this just to see what that looks like. And Regina Hall, yes, like being a PTA movie, like go girl, do that. So they have the title and kind of what it's about, all of that kind of under wraps, so we won't know for a while like what it'll be about. But I'm sort of excited. I didn't watch Licorice Pizza, and I heard some very conflicting things about it, so I probably won't watch it. But I did start The Master, so and I liked what I saw from some of that.
Yeah.
I need to, like, that's another thing I need to do is catch up on my PTA. So, like, before this movie comes out, I'll figure it out.
I think people were not expecting what they got with Licorice Pizza, because Licorice Pizza is mostly a coming-of-age story kind of movie. But I do remember seeing Gabrielle Union, like, she sent out a tweet when this was announced about Regina Hall, like, for Black actresses or actors to get cast in these roles and get offers is a really a big deal. Taraji's been talking about it. But she was like, she was in a meeting with a bunch of studio people, and they're like, yeah, Regina Hall is like one of the second most bankable actresses in the industry. And she was like, and Gabrielle Union was like, because she's a Black woman, she doesn't get the opportunities that Hollywood ranking dictates she should be given. This is in mention to Regina Hall being bankable as an actress. So I'm happy for her. You know, I hope it opens the door, and I hope that her success opens the door wider for Hollywood to open up the floodgates to hire other actors and actresses of color in these kind of roles.
Yeah. So what have you been watching this week?
Me personally, I've been watching The King's Speech. It's the story of Queen Elizabeth's father. He had a speech impediment. King Albert, or his Prince Albert, Duke of York, was his title before he became king. Mm. It's about him and how the Queen Elizabeth, how they overcame his speech impediment, and how it was an actual thing. Like, people were doubting his ability as king because of his speech impediment, and the camaraderie and the friendship he kind of developed with the speech therapist. Watching this movie, I didn't really get it. I could see why Colin Firth got a Best Actor Award in Oscars for this role, but not just that. I thought Helena Bonham Carter did an amazing job in this project as well. Kind of don't see her do a lot of serious stuff. We mostly see her, like, her husband, like, cast her in crazy stuff opposite Johnny Depp, you know, you know, doing whatever. But this movie just shows that, given proper, you know, material, I guess is the word I'm looking for, she is a wonderful actress as well. But yeah, I do love, because the thing about this movie is also, this man is supposed to be a king, and he's, you know, he's hypercritical and aware of his speech impediment. And you don't think, like, people at that level would be aware of their insecurities. They just say, fuck it, I got the power. But the fact that it was so, like, something he wanted to get over so bad. Yeah, I love the picture.
Yeah, I love The King's Speech. It was so good. But it's also, like, I think it was either produced or something by Peter Morgan, who does The Crown. So, kind of in the same vein. But, yeah, I really liked it, and I thought everyone did a really good job. It's one, I haven't watched it in a minute, but, like, I like how they try to humanize people who are, just by their nature, very mysterious and, like, almost inhuman, because they have to be so restrained in the role. I think that telling the story was good. And I have conflicting feelings about monarchy, so it's kind of like, sometimes it's hard to watch these things and be like, so are you, like, what are you trying to say? Are you for this or nah? I think Peter Morgan has stated how he felt about it, but it brings up some interesting questions. And also, like, what we expect from people in that role. Like, why did we think that he couldn't do the job just because he had a stutter? Who knows? So,
Yeah, and it's funny because I think David Sutter, the writer of this movie, was like, he was already writing about this from like the 1980s, and it was just because of his wife, where he's like, she made a request, and he's like, all right, we're not gonna work on it at all till after, you know, she passes away. Like, and I think that's like a tremendous amount of respect for somebody. Like, look, you're doing a movie about my husband and me adjacently, can you not until, you know, a certain time period? Like, that's like, yeah, I enjoyed that aspect of it as well.
Okay, so I watched The French Connection for the very first time. I watched this movie. It's directed by William Friedkin, who also directed The Exorcist, which I did not know, but wow, that's pretty cool. I read the description of this movie because I wanted to watch this for a while, because all of, you know, the big directors have talked about how iconic the chase scene is in this movie, and they keep talking about this movie, and like, I'm trying to up my film knowledge, so I'm just watching the things that people are saying are like really important movies in cinema. So I watched this and I read the description, and it's about like two New York cops who are trying to like investigate some drug ring or something that's going down. And I was like, this movie's gonna be hella racist. Before I even pressed play, I was like, this movie's gonna be hella racist. And it's a crime being psychic. Like, it absolutely was. Like, it was, the first scene is like two white cops chasing down a black man and beating him up. And the black man deals drugs, and it's like, okay, well, love it. Love a stereotype. Like, happy Martin Luther King Day, I guess. Yeah, so that sucked. There was like a whole sequence where they bust into a restaurant, these cops, and are like shaking black people down, and it's like an exclusively black establishment, and everyone's like either high or like hiding drugs, and it's like, all right. I had this conversation with my friend earlier, and I want to get your perspective on it, right? In terms of the movie, I thought it was fine. Like, I feel like I didn't like the main character because he was racist. So, like, I was like, I don't like you, and I don't care what happens to you. I hope you die. He doesn't, unfortunately. Him and his partner, the partner tried to be sort of okay and be like, we're all people. And it's like, no, you're still shaking down all these black people, so you can stop. I couldn't connect to the main character. So I was just like, I don't care what happens to you guys. And the whole thing is like a methodical investigation of like trying to figure out like what's going on. What is this French connection? These French drug dealers are doing something with these Brooklyn drug dealers. Like, what's happening here? So that's what the movie's about. The chase scene is really good. I will say, like, that is a great chase scene where he's like racing the train in a stolen car. Like, that was really good. I will say that. The tension and everything, I was feeling it. I feel like action scenes from back in the day is so funny because the way they cut it and the fake blood and how everything takes like an extra second for you to like, for it to register, like, this person has been shot. That's funny to me. That's hilarious. Like, I always laugh every single time. But in terms of the movie itself, I was like, I don't, who cares? Everyone gets busted who you think will get busted. And those cops they're terrible cops, and somehow they end up solving this case. Don't care about the cops. Sorry. Screw you guys. So I guess my question is like, how can I, as a younger millennial in 2023, watch older movies? Like, I'm really struggling with this because it comes up quite a few times in some of the movies that I've watched. Unless they're like foreign films, because for some reason, I'm sure they have their issues over there too, but it's not translating in the same way for me, I guess, when I'm watching some of these films, it's kind of hard. It's hard to watch it and not be like, I don't care about y'all. Please die. I don't know how to engage with that media. So,
I mean, it's kind of hard because, especially in this movie, French Connection, it's kind of, let's be honest, they're kind of corrupt cops in a way.
Yes, they are.
But, and those issues are still prevalent today. It's kind of like we mentioned Tar in the beginning of the episode, where, remember the movie where in the beginning they're criticizing a composer.
Yeah.
And the kid is like, oh, he was a womanizer, he was this, he was that. And she was like, does that negate his artistic ability? Are you viewing his talents, and are you holding his talents in regard using modern day sensibilities, or, you know, bygone era sensibilities? And it's kind of hard when you hit films like the 1970s-ish, where those same racial undertones still exist today. So yeah, it's kind of like what you said, like, majority of my older film knowledge, it wasn't, it's more so minor, more like, how should I say this? I think what TMC does is they kind of avoid showing these kind of pictures if you want to get into classic cinema and stuff. And that's kind of how it was for me. Like, Fiddler on the Roof, watching stuff like that with my mom. Seven Brothers, watching that with my mom. Those kind of pictures. Less French Connection-esque movies. More so the Harold classics that kind of the whole family can watch in a way. Kind of thing. It's kind of hard. I can't really describe, because like I said, my entry point into it was not like I went out and searched for it. Like, my mom was watching movies on TV, and I just, like, oh, what are you watching? I sat down, and that's how I'd watch older cinema. So it's weird. But to your credit, foreign films do a better job of avoiding these kind of topics a little better, in a way.
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, even when I was watching that French, what is it, Godard's film, Masculine and Feminine, that also had racist stuff in it. I'm trying to remember how they handled it. I think maybe
it was the train scene.
That one. Did he kill someone or did they kill him?
No, I think they, the girl was taunting them, and it was like a verbal back and forth, and it ended at that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's still in there somewhere. I guess it just depends on like how you handle it. I guess my question is, like, I want to go back and really watch these films that are, you know, important in cinema. Like, I was watching a thing earlier today with Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese when they did, you know, the Letterbox challenge where you have to like pick your four.
Yeah.
And they're like talking about the movies that inspired Killers of the Flower Moon. And the movies that Scorsese was bringing up, I was like, I've never even heard of these things before. Like, what are you talking about? But like, apparently they're important because they influence like the stuff that we know today and like our understanding of like film language and stuff. So I'm trying to go back and look at these things because I heard they're important, but I'm just coming up against my sensibilities and the sensibilities of the time in which they were made.
And that's also the thing, like, a lot of the films that inspired, like, guys like Scorsese, Spielberg, De Niro, all those guys, like, they are not known to us because those are the directors and auteurs they were watching when they were, like, our age. Yes. So now when you say what inspired you, you will say our Scorsese film. And then Scorsese will say, oh, in the making of this project, these movies inspired me. So you start going back further and further.
Yeah, so I guess I don't have an answer to that. I guess I just have to keep watching them and working through my feelings on this, because maybe I'm just over it. I don't know. But I wanted to watch a movie from this time, because this time in the 70s is when things started to shift a bit, and where you got Scorsese's and Spielberg. That's when they were really like coming out, reaching their peak. George Lucas, like, this was their time when they were extremely fertile. And their movies, which were more auteur driven, were the things that were box office successes. Yeah. And I feel like we're in a transition period now where it's like original ideas are starting to become more, I don't know if it's more profitable because we still have like IP stuff that are doing really well in the box office. But those are the movies that are like really driving something, driving some culture. There is like a hunger for those type of films now because we're so over the, you know, franchise stuff and the sequels and the prequels and whatever. So I wanted to watch something that kind of mimicked this time period that we were in now. I'm gonna keep trying. I guess that's my answer to this. I'm gonna keep trying.
Yeah, and I think our part of it is also the era in which you're watching it. Kind of like late, I want to say 1965-ish to like 70s. Mm-hmm. A lot of the movies were really hyper violent in a way. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of also like, and it kind of did get more hyper violent with your Rocky, not your Rockies, but oh my gosh, your Rambos, stuff like that. But with Rambo there was a reason to it. It's actually about abandonment of veterans. But a lot of those movies in that period were really hyper violent for some odd reason, you know. So
but I would agree with that. I actually, yeah. I think that's kind of fine. Like I'm okay with the violence. Like I really liked Raging Bull.
Yeah, and
that came out in 1980. Sorry, we're 10 years out from that. Okay, yeah. But did I see Mean Streets? I think I watched a little bit of it. I didn't think I finished Mean Streets, but I think, again, it's just how who's directing it and how it's handled. Because I feel like I can enjoy this stuff from this time period. It just depends on, like, how we're dealing with it. I guess the police brutality and the criminalizing Black people is just maybe I'm just watching it at the wrong time. Like, I don't want to hear about that stuff right now because we're still dealing with it and I'm still upset about it. So it's like, don't show me this person as the protagonist. I don't care what happens to this man. Like, he can choke for all I care. So it was just really challenging. But I will say what they were talking about when they talked about this movie, which was the chase scene, was good. So maybe I should have just skipped that part and just watched that and left the rest of the movie alone. I'll figure it out. I guess on my journey, I will figure it out. I just wanted to express how I was feeling because I had issues. So anyway, that is it for us this week. We hope that you're doing well. Make sure to check out all of our social media, support us if you can, and we will see you guys in the next episode. Goodbye.
Au revoir.